This is the Guthrie Center, formerly Ray and Alice Brock's house of Alice's restaurant's fame. It's home of the Guthrie Foundation. With us on the Folk Show is Arlo Guthrie. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's nice to have a couple moments in this beautiful place.
Well, it's a nice day and things are fine and I love this place, so any excuse to be here is fine with me.
So what happens here? We mentioned a few of the things that goes on here. What else is the foundation responsible for?
Well, the short version is that we formed this place about 12 years ago. And I was at home doing one of these Whatever Happened to Him TV shows, and we were filming around my house, and they said, well, let's go to that old church. And I hadn't been back here since 1969 when the movie came out that we made here. And I said, okay. So we drove on down here, and we were walking around, and the people came out who were living here at the time. I didn't know them. They said, hey, that's Arlo Guthrie. Let's get him to buy it. And I thought, oh, God, the last thing I need is another mortgage or another something to deal with. And I had, at that time, been getting computerized, you might say, and we had a mailing list that we were sending out newsletters to and show information and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know what? If every one of those people on that list that we had sent in $5, we could buy this thing. And then we would turn it into some kind of community, something or other. I really didn't know at the time. And so I sent out a newsletter and a postcards and said, everybody send me $5. Well, I think about 4,000 people sent me $5, which was enough at least to start. And so then I had to figure out, okay, what are you going to do here? So I was sort of on the horns of a dilemma, and I decided that we would try to continue, at least in spirit, the ideas that my mom and dad had raised me with and had sung about, or in my mom's case, danced about or worked in. And they were two incredible people who really wanted to make the world a better place and whose music and whose art and whose lives have touched a lot of people around the world. And I thought, well, maybe let's just start there. And so we formed two foundations. One is a spiritual foundation, an interfaith church, and the other is an educational foundation.
Arlo, I'm just wondering, you know, this is such a great tribute to your parents, Woody and Marjorie Guthrie. Are there any other tributes like this? Are there any other safe havens or establishments that seem to memorialize your parents like this around the world?
There are some institutions around the world that have been named after my mom and dad or one or the other. There's a place in Perth, Australia that's named after my mom because she did a lot of work with Huntington's disease. She founded a worldwide organization, and so they named one of these places after her over there. I went to visit it about 5 or 6 years ago. It was terrific. And of course, there's Woody Guthrie events everywhere. Everybody in music anyway knows who my dad is. And so there is always something. I just came from Okemo, Oklahoma, where we had the 6th annual Woody Guthrie Free Folk Festival, which was a terrific event. And but there's probably no place that where the spirit of both of them are housed together equally. There's nowhere really quite like this.
What do your children think of this legacy?
Sarah Lee's
an artist, Sarah Lee's a musician. Do you think she feels pressured being Arlo Guthrie's daughter?
Well, some people are. You know, I have a brother and a sister. We all reacted differently to having a famous dad and a famous mom in her own right. Some of us fared well, some of us fared less well. But all of us were changed by it. And as a matter of fact, there's a little page in People magazine this month that has a lot of sons and daughters of famous artists, and Sara Lee's one of them in there, and they were sitting around talking, and most of them said, oh, man, I hate this. It's a burden. You know, I got to do this. I got to do that. It can't be me. And she said, I love working with my dad. And I thought, what a nice thing for her to feel. I never had a chance to work with my dad professionally. I never even saw him work professionally. He was ill by the time I was 6 years old, hospitalized by the time I was seven, stayed in there until he died when I was around 21. So I knew him fairly well. We would visit him every week, and wasn't like out of the ordinary for us. So there's a lot of truck drivers didn't see their kids as much as my dad saw his. But when you're born into a certain briar patch, you deal with it mostly with your own abilities and your own skills and talents, and some people do better than others. Luckily, in our family, at least in this generation, everybody seems to be doing okay. I work with all of my kids. I have four kids. My son Abe plays with me on stage and has done since he got out of high school. My daughter Kathy, who's the next oldest, is out in L.A. She does all of the finances for the whole family. My next one is Annie. She's in Florida. She heads up my office down there, doing all the logistics, where we're staying, who we're talking to, how we're getting there, all of those things. And my youngest is Sara Lee, who's married now to a wonderful musician named Johnny Arion. And they play and sing on their own, and they also tour with me when they're not doing that. So I love working with them, because I get to know them not just as a parent and a kid, but as a regular person. You know, when you're on stage and you're singing with somebody, it doesn't matter if it's your kid or not. You got to be in tune. You got to show up. You got to sort of pay attention to each other. That's the greatest thing about being a musician. A lot of people think playing music has to do with an ability to do something, but it's really the ability to listen. That's what makes a musician.
Any projects underway as far as recording another Arlo Guthrie album?
Oh, there's always something going on with us. You know, we started about 4 years ago to do a project with the Dillards, if you remember those guys.
Yeah, sure.
They were so wonderful. Really the first, what I would call progressive bluegrass band, before they called it that. In other words, they were writing new songs of this, but within the same traditional sort of, with the same traditional sounds. And I just love those guys, always have, and have worked with them over the years. And I thought, you know, I want to do a record of my dad's songs that used to be popular. My dad gets a lot of credit these days for influencing people like Bob Dylan and stuff like that. People know that he wrote songs, but most of the young people don't know the songs that he wrote. They don't know what made him popular in the first place. And I thought, why don't we do a record of those songs, and let's do it with guys who come from his sort of neighborhood. And I thought the Ozarks are close enough to Oklahoma, and let's get these guys to do it. They are so wonderful. We went in the studio. We made a record. We worked on it for a while, and then we discovered that there was some glitches in the tape. We were using some a technology where we were sort of multi-tracking on multiple tape machines, and they were out of alignment, and we couldn't fix it, and we spent 2 years trying to fix it, couldn't do it. And I was so convinced it was going to come out. I even put it in my record catalog with pictures of me and the Dillards telling, you know, this is a great new record. And finally, at the last moment, I thought, I can't do it. It's not up to the standards that we have at our company. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't do these guys justice. And so we scrapped that. We're going to go back in the studio, re-record it, start from scratch, use the original tapes just as a roadmap. So that's one project that should have been out 2 years ago, 3 years ago. As a matter of fact, we even had a big concert at Carnegie Hall last November, which was supposed to be the release date for this record. We had the Dillards there. Pete Seeger was there. The Mammals were there. Johnny and Sara was there. Abe was there. Anyway, it didn't work out. So that's one. We're doing another record with a symphony orchestra, the Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra out of Washington, D.C., made up of some of the finest young musicians around the world who really wanted to be on this project. We did three shows with the orchestra. We did the Kennedy Center in Washington, the Landmark Theater. It used to be the Mosque in Richmond, Virginia, and ended with a show at Carnegie Hall. This was about 2 years ago. And in the meantime, between those shows, we went and recorded the orchestra parts, and I was supposed to add mine later because we didn't have time to do it all at once. It's expensive working with 60 people. And so I went back to do it about 3 months ago. We had scheduled it in, and all of a sudden I realized that the fact that the orchestra wasn't actually playing with me when they recorded it meant that they were playing in orchestra time. They got faster, they slowed down, they did this, they did that. It was impossible to play with these guys. They're not used to playing with somebody that actually has rhythm. And so we're now in the process of either re-recording that or trying to figure out a way that I could play along and do my parts. Because really, it is, most of the time I don't like recording part at a time. But this is an exception in that my contribution is another part to 60 other people playing. And it's the same every night. That's the one downside of working with people who only read music is that you have to play the same thing with them. You can't have a few extra beats or another measure here.
A little jam with the orchestra.
You can't, yeah, they don't jam so well.
No.
So that project is on hold until we can fix that, but hopefully that'll be out soon also. So, yeah, there's stuff we're working on all the time. We've had a couple of bad years in terms of problems technically, but we're always trying to get new stuff out. The idea came up that we were going to maybe possibly sell T-shirts at shows, and all the purists said, "Oh, my God, he's selling out." It was about that same time that Warner's said to me, Gordon Lightfoot, Van Morrison, Bonnie Raitt, and a couple other people, they said, "You know, disco's big now. We don't really need you guys anymore." And they dropped us all in one night. And that was an obvious mistake in the case of some of these folks. Maybe not so obvious with me. So I thought, we got to find ways to raise enough money to make new records. And so we started doing T-shirts, and it evolved to pencils and books and all kinds of other ridiculous stuff. And I thought, nobody's going to actually want to buy this. Then the web came along, and it's a booming business for us. I mean, we do most of our business worldwide over the web. I mean, it's easier to find me on my website than it is to go to Warner's and try to look for me. So I think that's why some of these record companies are scratching their heads and wondering what to do. But I think this is the best thing that could have possibly happened for all musicians, is that we finally get the music back. We're smart enough now to copyright and publish our own stuff. Some of us have been able to have enough catalog to have a little clout to make your own CDs and, you know, use that. But the days are gone when the record companies would invest in anyone anyway, so you might as well do it yourself, and it's paid off for us. I mean, nobody's getting rich off of this thing. We're not tooling around in yachts up and down the waterways, but in terms of actually keeping the money that other people would have kept to make the same records. And not only that, we've created a community of people around the world who talk with each other, who write with each other, who meet up at gigs with each other, who have little to say about me these days, because they already said that. They keep up with each other's lives now. I love that. What a fabulous thing the web has become. And for up-and-coming musicians, what a way to reach the world. I can't think of a better way. And not only that, the great thing is that now the music belongs to the people who are making it. These festivals are filled with people who love this traditional kind of music or modern music, whatever you want to call it. But it's totally under the radar of the record industry. You would never hear anything about any of the people I hang out with from the big record guys. You're not going to see me on VH1 or MTV or something like that. But somehow or other, this music's become so popular that you can't even find a decent instrument on eBay anymore. I mean, for a decent price.
Do you get to play with those folks much? Pete Seeger playing much?
I just did a show with Pete. He was at the Woody Guthrie Festival in Okemah, Oklahoma, and it was great. I mean, he's getting to the point where he keeps complaining. You know, he says, well, my voice isn't what it used to be. And I say, Pete, neither is the hearing of all of them people been coming to see you for years. And he says, okay. And we, you know, we talk him into trying to do stuff, but his grandson, Tao Rodriguez Seeger, is a wonderful musician, plays with a group called the Mammals. And Tao keeps me up on what's going on with his grandpa. And he says, well, Pete's only doing the things he thinks are fun. And at 80, whatever Pete is, it's about time. It's about time that he just goes out and does the things that are fun. I'm actually practicing to be as old as Pete. And so I generally do things that I think are fun. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes not. But there's nobody that I think is more responsible for the way we think of music, the way it becomes a part of our life, that we understand that it's really ours and not just, that we understand that it's, that entertainment is one small part of music, but it's not the biggest part, and it's probably not even the most important part. That music is bigger than that. It's part of who we are, part of our traditions, part of our cultural heritage, and it defines us. And not only that, it gives us a language that we can speak internationally with anybody else in the world, because in this particular American folk music culture, it's been contributed to by people from everywhere. That's probably why it's so popular around the world. No one's more responsible for that than Pete Seeger. And I think my dad gets a lot of the credit, but really it's Pete who is the sort of founder of what we call modern folk music.
Arlo Guthrie, if there was something, one thing that you would want to be best known for, do you have any idea right now what that would be?
Well, it's sort of like the guys that asked me. A few years ago, I remember a big publisher came to me and said, Arlo, you know, everybody's writing books. You ought to write a book. You ought to write your autobiography. And I said, well, I'd love to, but I'm just waiting for a good ending. You know, so when something good happens, you know, I mean, then I'll be able to sort of put it in a box and say, okay, that's me. But unfortunately or fortunately, however you look at it, you know, life is very interesting, and we do live in interesting times. Thank God for that. How boring it would be to live in a time where everybody's just happy and walking around, you know, like some monster movie after the monster's dead. It's really no fun. That's why they stopped the movies there. So from my point of view, I think we do live in great times. We live in times when people are waking up again, which is good. I mean, the whole world is sort of crawling around, opening their eyes a little bit. And I'm just happy to be a part of it. I don't think it matters. You know, what we do here is a small thing. It's great for us. Keeps us busy and out of trouble, well, mostly. But I think if everybody just did a little bit, I don't think there's ever been a time when you could do so much and have it mean, you know, you could do so little, frankly, and have it mean so much to so many people. This is a very interesting time, and you don't have to do a whole lot to make a difference. It doesn't matter to me so much as it used to what people believe or don't believe. People's beliefs change, but the humanity that we share, that has to continue to grow. I was never so proud to see, before this last Gulf War, for example, the millions and millions of people around the world who were marching in the streets. Now, some of them were marching and sort of, let's go, and the others were saying, stay here, or whatever they were saying. It didn't matter to me so much what they were saying. The point was that it took 2 weeks to get to a place where it took 10 years to get to back 3 decades ago. That people began to believe that their voices counted for something. That, to me, was the most interesting thing and the most wonderful thing. Whether they thought we ought to do this or that was less important to me. That will change as events change, but the hearts of people that are unafraid to stand up and say what they think, to me, is the most important feature of what we have, or it's the most important responsibility that we have, to not be cowered into thinking that we ought to keep our mouths shut, or to think that somehow or other we don't owe it to everybody. My dad had the idea that if everybody stood up and said what they thought, then we'd get a pretty good idea how people actually feel. And it'd give us an opportunity to change our minds or to modify our views or something like that, and that eventually the good would come out of it. It's only when people feel as though they shouldn't say something or can't say something or it's dangerous to say something that we get ourselves into trouble. And to the extent that we are there now, that's the amount of trouble we're in. And the best way out of it is for people to continue saying what they think, and frankly, what they think doesn't interest me, but get out there, do it, say it, sing it.